Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Hello, and welcome to another of the New Abnormal special bonus episodes. We're so excited to have you here today. Today we have a very special guest with Masha Gessen, who's an author and journalist who writes brilliantly on authoritarians. So today we're going to have her teach us why we all should care about this subject.
We're so thrilled to have you today.
Thank you.
First, I want to talk to you. You wrote this piece in The New Yorker last week. Or this week, or today, who even knows?
In the Forever Tuesday, yeah.
Right, exactly. And it was, and I know you've written about this in your books, and you've written about this before, but it was so struck by it. And I wanted to talk to you about this idea that we kind of got off easy this time.
The piece I published right after the election was, we're still in the election. It's like we're always in March and always in the election. It's about the concept of an autocratic breakthrough. I borrowed that idea from a Hungarian sociologist, Balint Magyar, whose work I've used a lot. He's brilliant, and he's developed this very detailed model based on studying the Central and Eastern European democratic backsliding. And he divides autocracies into three stages: autocratic attempt, autocratic breakthrough, and autocratic consolidation. Now, what distinguishes the autocratic attempt is that it is reversible by electoral means. And the thing is, like, we don't know, or we don't necessarily always know, when the autocratic attempt is over, when it has passed into autocratic breakthrough. But he suggests that there are structural changes and institutional changes that aspiring autocrats put in place that create the process of autocratic breakthrough. And after you pass through the autocratic breakthrough, it is no longer possible to dislodge the autocrat by peaceful means. So what he looks at is what he calls the vertical of vassalage, which I think is a beautiful term. Weirdly, Putin uses a similar term and has used a similar term ever since he came to power 20 years ago. He was talking about vertical of power, or the power vertical. And by this, he meant that, you know, he thinks that the whole sort of system of checks and balances is really unwieldy. You just should have a single command center. And, you know, like, you figure that you decide what needs to happen at the top, and then it gets passed down to the bottom, and that's much more efficient. But the concept of vertical of vassalage is more evocative and more accurate, because it's like this vertical loyalty network. There are these people who are put in place by the aspiring autocrat, who are bound to him because he gave them the power. He often gives them the money or the access to accumulating wealth through power, and they owe him loyalty. And this is a very important thing to modern autocracies, right? They're all like mafia states, basically. So Donald Trump, what I'm arguing in this piece is that Donald Trump, not only is he refusing to admit electoral defeat, but he's actually trying to activate a vertical of vassalage that he's put in place. And so far, you know, it's not a terribly impressive one, but it's not an unimpressive one. What he's done is he's created these verticals that you can trace, you know, from Trump to Mitch McConnell to all the judges and three Supreme Court justices that Mitch McConnell got through the Senate. Or you can trace it through from Trump down to Bill Barr and the Justice Department that he's turned into his personal law firm or personal law enforcement agency and private law firm. We're seeing this vertical reacting in ways that Trump expects it to. You know, we're seeing Bill Barr sort of issue this weird memo, basically saying, okay, re-examine the votes before they've even been finally tallied up. We're seeing Mitch McConnell go along with refusing to admit electoral defeat. I think at this point, this vertical will probably not hold up Trump to the desired end of staying in power. but we can see the outlines.
Right, for the next time.
For the next time, exactly. And this is something Zeynep Tufekci wrote about it in The Atlantic. She suggested that the next autocrat will be more competent. I don't know that it's necessarily a question of competence. I actually think incompetence is something that autocrats weaponize really well. It's like the destruction they wreak is all the more effective and total because of their incompetence. But what I do know is that the incoming Biden administration will have to dismantle this vertical. And to dismantle the vertical, it will really have to examine what allowed it to be constructed.
Yes, and that's where your piece from today comes in. Will you talk a little bit about that? Because we just had Ellie on the podcast, too.
Uh-huh, great.
Yeah, I agree with this idea, too.
So the piece I published today on the day that we're recording is a piece in favor of reckoning. And I'm arguing against a fairly longstanding American tradition of sort of staying the hand of vengeance. Ever since Ford pardoned Nixon, there's been this idea that presidential magnanimity has to extend to his predecessor, and that the right thing to do politically is to move on. So there's a direct line from Ford to Barack Obama, who decides not to appoint a special prosecutor to investigate illegal detention and torture under President George W. Bush, or to even take a closer look at the Iraq War. Right? I think that Biden is poised. He and Kamala Harris signaled in their victory speeches that that unity and healing are their goals. And these are goals that I share, right? But I think that the way that American politics have generally pursued unity and healing is by kind of putting a Band-Aid on the thing and pretending it never happened. And I don't think that's what you do with a festering wound. I think you have to clean it out and then you stitch it up, and that's no guarantee of healing, but it's the best chance you have. You definitely can't let it fester. I try to take the argument a little bit away from this argument about whether we should have truth and reconciliation commissions or whether it should be sort of the regular institutions, regular trials, regular investigations, congressional hearings. I'm not sure that that's that important. Like, that's not the question.
Yeah.
The question is there a national commitment to reckoning? And we may not need truth and reconciliation commissions. Jill Lepore has argued, I think very forcefully, that we don't need them because we have regular institutions. And Ellie has argued back, you can't use those regular institutions. They failed. I think they're both right. We may not need to invent brand new rituals of storytelling, but we either need to use existing rituals of storytelling, right? And that's a weird way to refer to courts, but that's what courts are, right? They are ritualized story factories, and so are congressional hearings, and so are special counsel investigations, and so can be town hall meetings, so are certainly journalistic investigations. All of those are possibilities for a reckoning, right? But there has to be it can't be like some heroic prosecutor somewhere. It can't be the Southern District of New York pounding Trump into the ground. That's not the point. The point is not
right
to pound him into the ground. The point is to actually have a conversation about what happened to us,
right?
How we did it to ourselves, and how we can recover.
Right, and how we can prevent it the next. It almost feels like you're making a case for more narrative nonfiction.
I am perhaps making a case for more narrative nonfiction, but the problem with narrative nonfiction, again, you know, it's like if we leave it to, and of course, you know, I say this a couple of hours after Twitter went aflame because there are rumors that Trump negotiating $100 million worth of book deals, right?
Yeah.
Like, that's just disgusting. That's not the kind of narrative and nonfiction that I mean. But it also points up the problem. You can't leave it to profit-oriented publishing houses.
Right.
Whether it's, you know, long-form magazine articles or books. That's not where it happens. It has to be a public-oriented commitment.
Yeah. Like Nuremberg, but without the punishment, right?
Exactly, yeah. You know, Nuremberg, again, it created a story. Like, after Nuremberg, there was a story to tell about the Nazi regime. It had been written down, it had been documented, people had been heard. And a lot of the time where sort of truth and reconciliation commissions have functioned, it's where people who've suffered the trauma are voiceless. That's not always true in this country, right? We have longer legacies where people have been systematically deprived of their public voice, right? You know, the legacy of racism, the legacy of colonization. The story of the last 4 years is not necessarily primarily a story of the voiceless being suffering trauma, right? I mean, we're very voiceful here on the left.
Yeah. It almost feels like, and correct me if I'm wrong, but this is my own like experience of the last 4 years. What we've seen the most trauma inflicted on, besides the ICE situation and the children being separated from their parents and, you know, all of that really tragic, serious dictatorship stuff. The other thing I've seen, it almost feels like inflicted a lot of this trauma on federal government employees.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point that, you know, there's been a wholesale debasement of government. We have seen people, you know, who haven't lied about trying to stay in the system to stay in the House on fire, but actual, you know, people like Colonel Vindman or Fiona Hill, who I think truly tried to put out the fire while staying inside the House, right? And lots of people whose names we don't know in the State Department, in the national security establishment. I think that sort of the major national trauma, there's several nexuses. One is, as you mentioned, ICE, and we have all suffered moral injury by being complicit in the creation of concentration camps and putting children in cages. It's not like too grand a pronouncement to say that. It's just a fact. We have all been victimized and traumatized by the handling of the pandemic. To have a government that basically communicates that people's lives are disposable, that they're worthless, your family's lives, your friends' lives, your own life. I mean, that's a huge psychic. And again, to all of us, to people who suffered physically and financially, you know, got sick and God forbid died, but also to all of us who are watching this and feeling helpless to do anything about it. And of course, his reaction to Black Lives Matter, the fanning of more racism, the use of troops against protesters, that's also moral injury inflicted on all of us. And I think just like watching this debasement of government, right? It's like for 4 years, do you remember when he first replaced Obama on television? And it was like that sense of like, oh my God, this is just embarrassing to watch.
Yeah.
And then we lived with it for 4 years. You have to look and you have to listen, but it makes you ashamed.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to Quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. You know, there's something I've really been needing to get off of my chest lately, which is that everyone and their mother should listen to the Andre 3000 album because it lifts my spirits on a regular basis, 1000%. We all carry around different problems, big and small. And let's be honest, when we keep them bottled up, it can start to affect us negatively. That's where therapy comes in. It's like this safe space where you can unload all those burdens and start figuring out how to work through whatever's weighing you down.
Therapy can make a difference. I know this from firsthand experience, and it's not just for those who've experienced major trauma. It's for anyone who wants to improve their mental well-being. Therapy can help you learn coping skills. It can teach you how to set better boundaries, and it can make you be a better version of yourself.
If you're considering therapy, why not give BetterHelp a try? It's entirely online, which means it's convenient, flexible, and fits into your schedule seamlessly. Plus, getting started is as easy as filling out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist. And the best part? You can switch therapists anytime at no additional charge. So why wait? Take that first step towards a happier, healthier you with BetterHelp.
Get it off your chest with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/thenewabnormal today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/thenewabnormal.
To be looking and listening.
A lot of my friends who've lived in Russia and in Eastern Europe have, especially today, actually, but it also previously have really had a visceral horror. I was shocked by Trump's inauguration speech because I was like, the government isn't supposed to work against me. Like, you know, I didn't know that happened. But my friends who grew up in Eastern Europe and Russia were all like, they were, I think, ultimately more used to it, but also more terrified by it.
I think that's exactly right. But it's more familiar. I think it was more legible to people who've lived in autocracies. It may be Eastern Europe or Russia. It can be, you know, Berlusconi's Italy, Erdogan's Turkey, Netanyahu's Israel. There are lots and lots of examples around the world that prepare you to recognize what he's actually saying. And so, yeah, so you read it better and you get more scared faster.
You talk in this piece, and you've talked about this before, this idea of accountability. Everyone has been talking about this today because of this, you know, how, like, people are saying, well, you shouldn't hire anyone from the Trump administration. I'm hearing a lot of people looking for jobs in different businesses. And I have a friend who's someone they called. They said, I wasn't working for da-da-da, even if I was in the administration. So I'm curious to know what your feeling is on this.
My feeling on that is that the most important part is to have that be the subject of public conversation. Like, that's part of the reckoning. What happens to these people? Right now, what happens is that, you know, their career paths, and there have been so many people who have gone through that, the revolving door of that administration, that we know quite well what happens. They find work in think tanks. They get prestigious fellowships like Sean Spicer at Harvard Kennedy School. They get lucrative jobs in private business like Miles Taylor, the so-called anonymous.
The high-leveled.
Administration official who got a high-level job at Google, right? I mean, my personal feeling is that it should be embarrassing. It shouldn't happen. But I don't know, right? There has to be some way in which we think about this collectively.
Do you think that if there's sort of sunlight brought in, that we are less likely? Because my whole anxiety is that this is going to be 2024, and we're going to have a Tucker Carlson presidency. And, you know, I am no fan of Tucker Carlson by any stretch of the imagination, nor is he of mine, but he is much smarter than Donald Trump.
Right.
And so I feel like we have 4 years to sort of make sure this doesn't happen again.
Exactly. No, that's exactly right. We probably have less, right? The next election campaign is going to start in 2 years.
Your wish list to prevent this is what?
My wish list is that Joe Biden stops saying build back better and says we have to reinvent American democracy. What made this possible? And then all sorts of answers offer themselves, like the role of money in government, right? The role of money in politics, the gerontocratic duopoly that we call the two-party system, like the unregulated profit-driven media and with no alternative, like a system that has devolved to the point where the only way things to get done politically is for one party to have a monopoly on power. This is something that when we look at other countries, we get very leery, right, of countries that have, where one party has a monopoly on political power, meaning the executive branch and both chambers of a parliament. But in our country, it has come to the point where governing is almost impossible. Unless there's the trifecta. So these are things that we have to talk about, and that's just institution. And then what do we talk about culturally? What is it in us that made this possible?
Why do you think a place like the UK, they had Boris. Boris is basically, I mean, he's slightly smarter version of Trump, but a lot of the same sort of base instincts got him elected. Are European governments safer? Are we too dependent on a president? I mean, is this because of executive orders and, you know, Congress giving away its power?
You know, people have argued about this for a long, long time. And there are lots of people who will tell you that a parliamentary system, a multi-party system, and usually parliamentary systems are multi-party systems, right, is much safer against this sort of demagogue. But, you know, there are lots of European countries where that doesn't seem to have exactly held up. There's the counter argument that, and this is actually an argument that Hannah Arendt subscribed to, which is that, no, a two-party system is safer because in a two-party system, one party assumes the grave responsibility of government, right? And so, and that, and the possibility of being in power, like always being a hair's breadth from power, keeps parties from going over the ideological edge and sort of keeps things sane and keeps things responsible. Yeah, that may hold up until somebody like Trump shows up and goes over the ideological ledge without even realizing what he's doing. I think the answer is that there's no system that is foolproof. And democracy is not the building of systems. Democracy is a process. It's a process of negotiation. We create systems in order to facilitate the negotiation that is actually democracy, right? We create systems in order to have a conversation about how we live together as a country. And we have to keep recreating those systems and reinventing them, because otherwise they just get shaky and vulnerable. And like, you can't just like put a little spackle on them and keep living in them when they've had an infestation.
Do you think that this is also in some way a call for like a larger conversation about morality? And I don't mean morality in the sort of traditional morality. I mean more of like our, it feels, again, like our politics have gotten very removed from like, you know, the sort of questions of doing the right thing because it's right, which was sort of the larger, you know, that sort of ended with Nixon. And I wonder if there's any way to sort of unring that bell.
Yeah, I think that's a great leading question. And I you know, in my book, I talk about how moral aspiration is actually the only way to really oppose autocracy. Like where we've seen successful dissident movements, you know, movements that actually mobilize people around them, is where those movements have been based on moral aspiration. And, you know, and what we've seen with Donald Trump, look at the people that who scare him. There are people like John Lewis, like Elijah Cummings, like AOC and the Squad. Yes, not coincidentally all people of color, but I think perhaps more centrally, all people who place moral aspiration at the center of their politics. And he's like, you know, a witch afraid of water with them.
I think a lot about Ukraine because it ended up being such a central part of the Trump presidency. But it's also, I feel like that's an example of a country where they sort of took their power back.
You mean after the Revolution of Dignity?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you know, it's a country that's still in transition. It's like forever in transition. But I find the example of Ukraine in some ways incredibly inspiring, right? It's like a country that just keeps trying to get it right. And every time somebody comes along and they have lots of people coming along who try to usurp power, and the system is very fragile. It's very new. And so they succeed in usurping power for a little bit. And then the people say, no, gotta go, you know, let's try again. And they keep trying. And it's, you know, it's a really beautiful thing.
It's so interesting. Are you optimistic? Please tell me you're optimistic. No, don't tell me. What do you think? Are you?
I'm hopeful.
Okay.
I think it's distinct from optimistic, right? I'm hopeful because I think that times of crisis are also times of great political opportunity. We know this, right? This is like empirically shown. And even in the last year, we've seen it at least twice. You know, we see incredibly inspiring things and huge shifts in the way that people think politically that happen in the middle of like some dire crisis. So there's great possibility. And I'm, you know, I'm of course disheartened that 70 million Americans with probably no benefit of Russian interference or aliens from outer space cast their votes for Donald Trump. But I'm also like, I love these people that we've elected in the end.
This is true. Like, if you look at Bolsonaro, I always say it wrong, Bolsonaro, the secret for these populists to stay in power is they give people money, right? I mean, or at least that's what happened there. And so I'm sort of amazed that it never occurred to Trump to do that, and people still voted for him.
I would push back against that a little bit. I think autocrats actually thrive on scarcity and instability. What they do is they dangle the carrot of stability and the carrot of prosperity, but it never comes. But it's like the harder, the more anxious people are, the less likely they are to opt for change.
Are you surprised that Putin didn't interfere more in this election?
I mean, I don't know to what extent he interfered. But look, I think that Russian trolls got incredibly lucky 4 years ago. And we've been very stupid to focus on it as much as we have. And I've tried to say that over the last 4 years over and over. It's not like they had some huge, brilliant operation. They're agents of chaos, right? We know what they do. Agents of chaos, apparently, and it shouldn't come as a surprise, can have amazing success and outsized influence in conditions of chaos. But they didn't create it. They just stumbled into it. It's like their ideas of America actually happened to meet America where it was. And that's the problem. Like, the problem is not Russian interference. The problem is that we sank so low 4 years ago that, like, we met Russian interference where it came in.
Right. That makes a lot of sense. Oh, this is so interesting. Thank you so much for that.
Thank you for the conversation.
On that note, we'll wrap up this episode of The New Abnormal from The Daily Beast. In future episodes, we'll be talking with smart folks from The Daily Beast and beyond, from media, culture, politics, and science, who will help us understand what's happening to our country and the world.
We hope you'll subscribe to us on your favorite podcast app and share the show on social media. We're just getting started and don't want you to miss an episode. If you'd like to follow us on Twitter, I'm Molly Jongfest and he's the Rick Wilson. Thanks so much for listening and we'll see you again on the next episode.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.